You're listening to the free edition of Sweden in Focus from The Local. If you would like to listen to a full-length version of the podcast, as well as an additional midweek episode, please check the episode notes for details on how to upgrade to Membership Plus. Here's this week's free edition.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Sweden in Focus, the Local's podcast looking back at the week's main news in Sweden. We're recording this on Thursday, the 12th of May. Later on this week's show, we'll examine why Sweden is getting tougher on immigration. And to help us understand, we've enlisted the help of Tove Hovemyr, a public policy expert at Sweden's Fores think tank. That's up a little bit later. Before that, we'll look at what Boris Johnson was doing in Sweden this week, how a translation error made national news, and why the Eurovision Song Contest is so enduringly popular in Sweden. I'm Paul O'Mahony, and I'm joined for today's podcast by James Savage here in Stockholm and Richard Orange and Becky Waterton in Malmö. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
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 How has your week been?
Interesting. There was a lot of interest in the Swedish media about Boris Johnson coming yesterday. So that took up quite a lot of my day trying to explain Britain and their NATO policy to Swedish media.
My mum sent me a message this morning saying, don't get too excited about Boris being in Sweden today, Becky. He always leaves the country on Wednesdays to avoid Prime Minister's questions.
And Richard, you've had an interesting week, I know. Tell us.
Yeah, I bought some new snazzy roller skates because my daughter's quite into it. Malmö's got incredible skate facilities, so I decided to go to Stapelbedsparken and I broke my wrist in three places.
No!
I was being very cautious, but this sort of young, sort of 4 foot high kind of meteor on a skateboard kind of whizzed in front of me and sent me flying and I landed and it's actually lifted my mood a bit somehow. I don't know why. Like somehow everyone I meet, I've got a little story to tell. Ow, it hurts quite a lot. And just kind of makes everyday tasks slightly more challenging.
I have been going to ceramics classes for a couple of weeks now and I got my first kind of bit of ceramics back on Monday and it was a little frog which now sits on my desk. So I've had a great week looking at my little frog sitting on my desk.
It's really impressive actually. It's a pretty excellent piece of
art. Hasn't got a name yet. I just call him Gruda.
You need to put the Gruda on the Local's Twitter account so that all our listeners can see it.
I will publish that tweet on Saturday to coincide with no explanation and listen to our podcast if you want to find out why we're posting a picture of a ceramic frog. Like a teaser.
The Social Democrats are expected to approve a NATO application this Sunday, and with the opposition fully on board, it looks increasingly likely that Sweden will join the Transatlantic Defence Alliance. On last week's podcast, we talked about the Swedish and Finnish Prime Minister's joint visit to Berlin, and this week, as we heard at the start, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson came up to Stockholm and Helsinki. What was the purpose of his visit?
Basically, Boris Johnson came to Sweden to sign a security deal with Sweden, which lots of people are reading is to protect Sweden kind of in this grey area, in the grey zone between applying to NATO. If they do, what a mystery. Maybe they won't apply. Who knows? They're obviously going to apply. So it's protecting this period between applying for NATO and then accession to NATO. But it's actually interesting. I was reading some commentary about this and there was Milena Brits, who is a researcher at the Swedish Defence University, was basically saying that this agreement is very similar to the security agreements that the EU have in the Lisbon Treaty. So she was kind of saying, this doesn't really have anything to do with NATO. It's just that when Brexit happened, we lost the support from the UK because they left the EU and they're not in this treaty anymore. And this new document is essentially a copy of whatever we get under the EU rules. So it's not specifically anything to do with NATO, but it has the nice benefit of giving us a bit of scope if we were to be attacked by Russia, that we could say, hey, Boris, can you help us out?
I spoke to Hans Wallmark, who was the moderator on the committee that created the report last night. I haven't yet written it up, But he was quite interesting because he made that point. He said, this is something we've been pushing for ever since Britain left the EU and haven't got. It's something that's long been on Sweden's wish list, and it's been slightly wrongly interpreted as, like you say, designed for that, to fill that fill the space during that grey zone. It's filling in what Sweden lost from the UK when Brexit happened. And what Hans Wallmark said was that the UK is by far the most important defence military force in Europe. So to lose that for Sweden was really kind of worrying.
Yeah.
I think the French would have something to say about that. But but yes, this is clearly a replacement for European defence. But the timing is very significant, given that Sweden is likely to apply to join NATO in the next few days, effectively, next few weeks. So, you know, yes, it's a replacement for European defence, but it's deeply connected to the NATO question, and it's deeply connected to Russia. And what he was saying was about sending a signal, as much as anything else, to the Russians to say that, look, don't mess with Sweden, don't mess with Finland, because they will be supported. They're not going to be on their own during this accession process.
What did you think about the boat, the Harpsons Eiken, that Boris Johnson rowed Magdalena Andersson out in?
I thought it was very stereotypical and very telling that Magdalena Andersson was wearing a life vest and Boris Johnson was not.
Exactly. And he was rowing as well. He had the oars.
Yeah. But I think that seems to be a tradition, that the guest always rows.
No, I've been going through all of the old things, and Khrushchev rowed Targa Irlander in 1964. So Khrushchev took the rowing position. But if you look over the history, it seems to be kind of random whether it's the host or the probably whoever's the greater oarsman.
But I think that boat trip is where Magdalena Andersson, because Boris quoted, or Boris Johnson, I should maybe say his full name, he quoted Magdalena Andersson in the press conference saying, yes, Magdalena Andersson, like you said, on the lake, we are now in the same boat, both literally and metaphorically. So I think that must be where she had that conversation.
This week, we're asking listeners to share your feedback about the podcast in a survey that you can find a link to in the episode description on your app. We'd be very grateful if you could take a couple of minutes to answer the questions and let us know what you think. Now, a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, we chatted about the Christian Democrat leader Ebba Busch's explosive comments about how the police should have opened fire on demonstrators during the Easter riots. That story sailed back into the news this week due to a translation error. Can you tell us what the story is there, Becky?
Yeah, so essentially the background behind this is that Radio Sweden have a number of news desks in different languages. Some of those news desks had mistranslated Ebba Busch's quote. So this was her quote saying, why were there not 100 injured Islamists rather than 100 injured police people? This whole, we were talking about a few weeks ago, the whole you should be shooting people quote, which is controversial anyway. But these news desks had translated it as, why were police not shooting 100 Muslims instead of Islamists? Which obviously has a much different, especially when you're a news desk in Arabic, where a lot of the people listening to this this radio channel will be Muslims, telling them that the Christian Democrats want to shoot Muslims is a slightly different message than want to shoot Islamists. So that's kind of the story behind this. And, you know, Ebba Busch has said that she requested a meeting with Radio Sweden to kind of talk about this, and they said no. And now she's saying that she's going to boycott them before the election. And this isn't just Radio Sweden. This is like the whole of Sveriges Radio, like the public service broadcaster. If she carries out this kind of boycott, this means there won't be any radio interviews with Christian Democrats before the election in kind of protest against this, because she feels like they haven't done enough to apologise for it.
How is Radio Sweden dealing with the fallout, James?
Well, after a bit of a slow start in responding to the fallout, they've taken some measures now. So they now say they've gone through all the publications and they found errors in 5 out of 25 articles or radio reports. They say that most of the articles and radio reports on Radio Sweden, that's to say these foreign language services, were correct. The errors they found were in 3 languages. It was Arabic, Kurdish and Somalian. But they say there were no systematic errors. It was just individual one-off errors. The reasons were unintentional errors and translation difficulties and pressure of time and stress. So what they've said is they're going to strengthen the management training, and they will use external expertise more often to avoid errors like this in the future.
And Richard, you wrote an opinion piece during the week about how Sweden has long sought to assimilate immigrants into Swedish culture rather than embracing multiculturalism. And this is sort of linked to this story. What prompted you to write the article, and what do you think are the main consequences of Sweden's approach?
It's not, I don't think it's so much that they're sought to assimilate immigrants into Swedish culture. It's more that the sort of mainstream Swedish culture is so blind to the existence of other cultures, or to the idea that people might want different things or might approach things differently, that there's a sort of massive total lack of curiosity towards other cultures and what they might be able to contribute. There's like, here's the Swedish system, you're here, get in and do it. The sort of society as a whole has never thought, well, maybe these people could bring something new. Maybe we need to adapt this so that it better fits the way the people who've come to Sweden works. And what sparked it was my experience of working for Radio Sweden, where all this happened. So I was right across the corridor from the Arabic division and the Somali division. And they were all, you know, some really great journalists who had done some really good stuff back in their home countries before they came to Sweden. You know, they're cosmopolitan. A lot of them write books and novels. They're, you know, a really interesting bunch of people. And what Sweden does with these people, rather than sending them out into their communities, which are kind of like a black hole for Sweden, nobody knows what most people in the Arab-speaking parts of Sweden think. It's like it's opaque to us. These people could have been sent out there to get stories from the bottom up and report that back through Swedish radio, both to their own communities, but also to the rest of Sweden. We'd know what were the concerns and what were the problems being faced by Kurdish or Somali or Arab people. And we don't now. Instead, what Swedish radio does is makes them translate Ekot, which is the sort of standard news bulletin diet that everyone has to consume, is supposed to consume in Sweden, so they know what are the essential things. Oh, the social Sturluson has come up with a new method of taking out wisdom teeth or something. You know, it's some really kind of solid, stodgy fare. And I just think it's a tremendous waste. And I think it's emblematic of the way Sweden has wasted the people who've come here and wasted their talents. Basically, Sweden, the Swedish system, sees immigrants as low-skilled labour and tries to feed them into the sort of incredible sort of sausage machine of this. And if it doesn't work, they don't think there's anything wrong with the approach or that the system needs to be adapted. They just think that the input needs to be changed. We need more training, more education. And I just thought that the waste I saw at Radio Sweden is kind of emblematic of one of the problems with how Sweden's approached integration. Having said that, you know, I don't think integration in Sweden is a disaster. I mean, there's lots of people, there's lots of successes as well, but it could have been done so much better.
I think a lot of this as well, you can see this in the Social Democrats saying we're going to fight failed integration. And I think that kind of, it's kind of an us versus them thing. Like, I think it would be much better if they were saying we're going to work together to solve the issue of failed integration. But I don't like the kind of we're going to fight integration. We're going to turn every stone to fight segregation. It's like, maybe you don't need to fight it. Maybe you can talk to the people that you want to integrate and see what would help them integrate. Like, do they know what it is you expect them to do? Or are you just expecting them to kind of build, if we're going to use a Swedish kind of stereotype, are you expecting them to build some IKEA furniture without having a manual? Like, maybe give them the manual and tell them what you expect them to do rather than just sitting them down with all the pieces and saying, yeah, why haven't you done this yet?
Even if you leave the integration perspective, if you just look at it from a journalistic perspective, it would be so much more interesting to hear these journalists, to hear what they would find if they did their own reporting. I mean, this is no criticism. There's no general criticism of Ekot and Sveriges Radio, because they, you know, it's a great journalistic organisation as a whole. But, you know, but in these foreign language services, it's a bit of a missed opportunity.
I mean, maybe we're biased because Sweden's news in English. We provide a service that gives relevant stories to people that speak English in Sweden. It's all picking relevant stories and figuring out which bits, okay, are people going to know what a Bostadsrättsförening is? Or should I add a little bit of context there? Is this story important for people? Maybe it's more important to cover this story on work permits, which is almost not featured in the Swedish news.
But Richard, yeah, this article, your opinion piece, goes beyond this story and you make some observations on how the Swedish left and right view culture or view foreign cultures in general. Can you tell us what you say there?
Yeah, I mean, I've got this. This is one of my bugbears. I mean, I've got this feeling that in Swedish consensus ideology, which is sort of based around a sort of social democratic thing, that culture does not exist. There is no such thing as a Swedish culture. We're just rational. And the way Swedish society has been constructed is not
a cultural artifact. It's just a sensible way of organising things. It's sensible to eat your dinner at 5:30 in the evening and then do some sport and to eat this sort of Lagom cuisine and not be extreme. And there's a sort of a lack of recognition that Sweden isn't quite an extreme country and that almost anyone, no one else in the world lives like that. People want to stay up late and, you know, party all night and not think about tomorrow, and that this is a cultural thing. And I think part of the problems that Sweden's had with immigration is that Swedes don't realise they even have a culture, or a lot of Swedes. And so when they see people not doing the same things that a Swede would do, they see it as just wrong, you know, and they don't understand that it's a cultural difference.
By the time you listen to this podcast, it'll either be just before this year's final of the Eurovision Song Contest gets underway, or it will all be over and you will either be elated or deflated depending on whether or not you did surrender to its charms. But if you live in Sweden, you will find it hard to avoid because Eurovision is huge here. Can you give us a sense of how popular it is, Becky?
It's exactly what you say. Eurovision is huge. Eurovision is so huge that the selection contest for choosing the entry to Eurovision is Sweden's most popular TV show. And like, it's not just one evening. It's like stretches over like all of February and March. It is literally, Mello is like the most popular TV show in Sweden. And then obviously that extends to Eurovision. And like, not just that, but if you win Mello in Sweden, your career is set. You are famous. You are a famous musician in Sweden. You will have you can have like a full on career just based off Mello. And then like if you go to Eurovision, that's seen as like it launches your career. The system for picking a Mello winner is very similar to the system for picking a Eurovision winner. It's all got, you've got juries, you've got public votes, all of this. So they kind of have this very well developed system which is kind of designed to emulate Eurovision, which is one of the reasons behind Sweden are maybe second out of all countries in Europe for Eurovision wins behind Ireland.
What about the Swedish entry? Does it stand a chance?
Bookmakers have got it kind of pretty high up on the list. I think a lot of people were saying it could be top three behind Ukraine and Italy. I don't know if we'll win. I think Ukraine's probably going to win, but I think we've got a good chance of coming top five.
We're going to turn now to immigration, and we're going to look at how the political consensus in Sweden has become a lot less welcoming to immigrants in recent years. First, we're going to listen to an interview with Tove Hovemyr, a public policy expert at the Liberal Fores think tank. I spoke to her earlier this week about how public attitudes to immigration in Sweden have changed over time. Let's hear what she has to say.
Well, if we look back just 30 years ago, already then Sweden welcomed a large number of asylum seekers due to the Yugoslav wars, which with its peak in 1992, where we had over 80,000 asylum seekers that year. And at that time, we also saw at the same time an increase in right-wing nationalism with the party Ny Demokrati, who got elected into the Swedish parliament in 1991. But they only stayed one term, though, so they weren't that long-lived. In the 1994 national election, they didn't get enough votes to stay in the parliament. But we could see already then a backlash after a vast increase in refugees and asylum seekers. And this is not a new phenomenon in these days. So we could see that kind of tendencies already back then. But when we entered the 21st century, public opinion towards migration became more and more positive over the years, especially during the liberal government from 2006 to 2014, Alliansen. We had many reforms on the immigration policies, especially one great reform with the liberalization of our labor migration laws, but also when it came to some small liberalizations of the asylum regulation as well. But during these years, where these liberalizations happened, we also saw the right-wing nationalist party, Sweden Democrats, come into the parliament in Sweden. So we also saw a surge in right-wing populism and nationalism also in the public opinion, mainly reflected, of course, in their election results. They came into the parliament and has continued to grow in the national elections since. And then, of course, the 2015 refugee crisis happened. And after that, the public debate and attitudes towards migration has remained restrictive since. and to this day. And the temporary asylum laws regulations is now permanented, actually, as asylum law as of last summer.
And where do you see the debate going in the coming months with the election coming up this year?
Besides the question of asylum policy, one of the biggest fights I will think we will see in the immigration issues the upcoming years after this election, I predict the Labour migration policy in Sweden to be up for debate, since the two major parties in Sweden both want it to be restricted in different ways. I just want to explain what they want. The Social Democrats basically want to reinstate the policy that that was before the reform in 2008, where labor migration was only allowed in the sectors or industries where there was a lack of workforce. And the ones who decided or could measure if there was a lack of workforce was the unions and the government. And the moderate party wants a restriction that says that labor migration will only be allowed if the salary is at least at approximately 27,000 Swedish krona, which could mean that a lot of labor migration that we have today, which we also need today, like berry picking or workforce that don't need that high of education, like people at restaurants and hotel workers, those aren't high in Sweden, that it would measure up to this level. And what concerns me is that when these proposals came, the one from Social Democrats was now just in late of April that they came with this proposal, is that I don't see the defensive reactions from liberal politicians who support the labor migration policy today as I would expect. And this is concerning, because I think that many still sees immigration and being pro-migration as something dangerous due to the public opinion. And it might mean that the fight remain the liberal labor migration law that we have today won't be as great as I would hope it to be.
That was Tove Hovemyr from the 4S think tank. Now, in 2015, as she touched on, the consensus was that Sweden needed to give shelter to refugees fleeing the war in Syria. Now, 7 years later, and with millions of refugees from Ukraine fleeing to mostly neighbouring countries in Europe, where would you say that we are in terms of the consensus, James?
Well, I think that lots of European countries' attitudes towards receiving people from Ukraine has changed that debate about migration quite significantly. With this being on our doorstep, with it being caused by Russia, you know, and some would say because Ukrainians are European, and some would infer a kind of racism in this reasoning, that there's been much more openness and sympathy towards Ukrainians and a greater willingness to accept significant numbers of refugees from Ukraine. But at the same time, I think when you look at other forms of immigration, you're still seeing clamp down on labour migration. You're still seeing a move towards less generous rules on labour migration. There are three parties that have a more liberal attitude to migration now: the Centre Party, the Greens, and the Left Party. But the other parties that have been more liberal on migration issues before, particularly the moderates and the Liberal Party, have now very much gone over to a much more restrictive view on migration. And the Social Democrats, absolutely, they're the crucial party that really decides where Sweden's going to go in all of this, because they are by far the largest party, and they've been the governing party for the last 8 years.
So of the former centre-right alliance parties, only the centre, as you say, remains largely pro-immigration after the Liberals chose to side with the moderates and Christian Democrats, who've taken a harder line on immigration. Richard, do you think the centre party leader, Annie Love, will stick to her guns and continue to argue for liberal immigration policies?
I think she has to. And she staked her entire leadership on not governing with Sweden Democrats and not taking part of a coalition that has the backing of the Sweden Democrats. And the reason for that is because of the Sweden Democrats' immigration policy. So for her, the immigration question is absolutely central to all of the choices she's made for the party for the last two elections. So I think it's really interesting to see her in this election, because she came out with this big opinion piece in DN that was very sort of stridently making the case against this kind of more restrictive, not just policy, but also the rhetoric that's coming from the other right-wing parties on immigration. She wrote this big opinion piece, and then in the kind of election debates, the party leader debates, she's come out as the sort of the staunchest defender of a more liberal approach to immigration and integration. And I think it's really interesting, because previously she was still part, that position still put her more or less in the consensus, But now she's looking kind of isolated. It's her and the Greens and Green Party leader Mette Stenevi who are really making a sort of positive case for immigration. Even Nooshi Dadgostar, who's trying to win the sort of social democrat, industrial, you know, old school social democrat strongholds in the north, she's sort of toning down the left party's support for immigration as well. So I think it's only these two. And because Sweden's a sort of consensus society, it changes the whole atmosphere of the debate to have only one person making this position. In a way, she's in the position that Jimmy Åkesson was 10 years ago, where he's the kind of lone dissenting voice. So I think it's really interesting that the switch there's been.
It's interesting what you say about the industrial kind of left strongholds as well, because my husband used to work as a machinist in kind of social, like what used to be a social democrat stronghold, you know, ELO, the big union organization. Like they kind of always counted on workers, kind of manual labor workers voting for them. But he was saying that everyone votes Sweden Democrat in the workshop that he used to work in. They've completely lost all their votes to the Sweden Democrats. And like that must be because of immigration. So that must be kind of what Nooshi's trying to win back.
From an electoral point of view, if we're thinking about, as most politicians do, maximising your share of the vote, this kind of works for her in the sense that it means that she has that. She's the only one representing the former view of the entire kind of centre-right coalition. So those who dislike the previous part of the centre-right coalition, that you know, moderates, the Christian Democrats and the Liberals, have gone over to sort of doing deals with the Sweden Democrats, to accepting Sweden Democrat support and promoting a much stricter immigration policy, not just on asylum, but also on labour migration. She can at least then rely on a solid base of support among those voters who dislike this change in policy.
If you're further right than the Social Democrats, but you're pro-immigration, then now you've only got one party you can vote for.
Right. One of the people she likes to compare herself to, I'm not sure he would accept the comparison, is Emmanuel Macron. You know, this idea that sort of kind of liberal on migration and liberal on economic policy, and that way sort of being in the middle of politics, in the centre of politics, but in a very specific kind of way.
I mean, the party that they would love to be, I think, is the Social Liberal Party in Denmark, Radikale Venstre, who've been every government for decades, they have extracted, like Annie Lööf did in the January agreement, you know, amazing policy concessions. They basically get what they want every time because they're the party that can swing both ways. And they're very much of the radical centre in that they have big reforming ideas, but they're not kind of extreme on in terms of, you know, traditional sort of left-right divisions. But they are radical. You know, they do want to change things.
I think she just wants to be bigger, a new boy in from Borden. I mean, it's like this little centrist party that ends up providing the prime minister and changing the country, I think, yeah.
Yeah, there was talk about that last time around, that she could end up as prime minister. But she didn't in the end.
No, but, you know, it's always a possibility. You know, when the deadlock lasts sufficiently long, there's always a possibility for some party like that to provide the solution. I think both the moderates and the Social Democrats it would be over their dead bodies.
So while Sweden is getting on tougher on immigration, as we've been saying, there is some good news for non-EU workers in a law due to come into force at the start of next month. Can you tell us about that, Becky?
It's this whole work permit law they're bringing at the end of this month, which is meant to kind of cut down on the amount of talent deportations that are happening. So that's people that get deported for minor administrative errors. But another part of this law, which hasn't really been highlighted, is that it's ending the so-called seven-year rule. So previously, if you'd had two 2-year work permits in Sweden in a 7-year period, that meant you couldn't apply for a third one or a fourth one. That meant so you could have maximum two 2-year work permits in a 7-year period, which was kind of a big issue for lots of talented IT workers in particular, because you would maybe be granted a 2-year work permit, you'd come to Sweden, you'd work on a project that was finished after 6 months, and then you'd go back to your home country, which meant that you could only do that twice in a 7-year period. After that, you were kind of locked out of the work market.
I think the issue is that the idea is that then you would, instead of having another work permit, you would get permanent residency.
Yeah,
but if you've been doing short contracts, you won't fulfill the requirements for
that. Because for permanent residency, I think you have to have worked for 4 years in the last 7 years, which obviously you have if you've got two 2-year work permits and you've been in Sweden for that entire time. But if you've been granted two 2-year work permits and you've only done 6 months out of each of them, you can't get permanent residency either. So you're kind of in a bit of a find there. You can't get a permanent residency to stay in Sweden, and you can't get another work permit to kind of earn up this four year requirement. So they've got rid of that, which is good. So yeah, you spoke, Richard, you spoke to a lawyer who said that a third of her case is related to the 7 year rule, which was going to make a big difference to people, which hasn't really been published because I think it is actually a major change for a lot of people. It will make it a lot easier for people to come to Sweden on shorter contracts.
I think calling it a rule is slightly a misnomer because I'm not sure it's more a practice. It's how the migration agency has been interpreting the law, and it's not something that it's not. There isn't a document saying this is the 7 year rule. It's the practice, and this and under the new work permit law, it says that they should be more sort of forward looking, and so they should, you know, you should see whether you meet the conditions to fulfil your requirements for a work permit this time, but they won't go back 7 years into your past and go, well, actually in 2017 you failed to get this insurance, and you know, two work permits ago.
Yeah, exactly.
And that, for that reason, mm-hmm. we're not going to renew your work permit.
Yeah, this was another aspect of the 7 year rule, is that if you'd had a work permit application that was incorrect within a 7 year period, they would say, okay, no, you can't have a new work permit. Which meant that you kind of had an embargo for 7 years just because something was wrong on your paperwork. And even if you've got a completely new agreement here, a new job, a new employer, everything, that kind of hung over you like a dark cloud until the 7 year period was up and you could come back.
Yeah, if you want to, you can just carry on applying for short term work permits. You don't have to apply for a permanent residency anymore.
And that brings us to the end of this week's Sweden in Focus. Thank you for listening, and thank you as always to my guests James Savage, Richard Orange and Becky Waterton, and of course Tove Hovemyr. Please check the episode description notes in your app and click on the survey there to share your feedback. And we'll be back again next Saturday. Until then, take care.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
That's all for this week's free edition of Sweden in Focus. If you'd like to hear a full-length version of the podcast each week, as well as an additional midweek episode with more interviews and analysis, please upgrade to Membership Plus. Make sure to check the episode notes for details on how to upgrade. Sweden in Focus is a podcast by The Local Europe. Our sound engineer is Rhys Edwards. The publisher is James Savage.